Hello, and welcome to another Sports Next Door podcast. My name is Owen. Today is Monday, July 11th, and I am joined, as I always am, by my neighbor Max. How's it going, my friend?
Good. Mostly same as usual. The biggest switch up this week or past week was after like a month of a string of concerts. There was kind of a lull. Managed to get out CCU Space Cowboy last Friday. I think it was Friday, and like tiny bar. I think there were maybe like 40, 50 people there. Small, intimate, violent occasion. loads of fun. It inspired me to hop on Bands in Town after chatting up a new friend I made at the show about potential concerts in the future. And I realized without noticing it, like six amazing ones have been announced in the next 3 months. So that's got me buzzing. Also probably because I had some coworkers that we could just jam out to like nonstop metalcore bangers in the truck today. So on a musical buzz at the moment. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing well, man. And you brought up the word buzzed, and I had to giggle because for those of you who will be watching on YouTube, potentially Max here, he got his haircut in what, first time in 2 years?
I always get the same friend to cut it these days, and we're pretty sure the last time it was cut was like August.
Yeah.
So you're being cheeky, but you're not that far off. Though I will say no buzzers were used on the head, just the back of the neck.
Very nice. Very nice. Yeah, man, I'm good. I'm a little burnt. I'm sure some of you can hear it in my voice, but spent the weekend in Ottawa at Ontario Regionals, Ultimate Frisbee. Really good time. First two-day competitive tournament that I've played in 3 years. So really, really awesome to be back on the field and had a lot of great moments. And yeah, definitely reminded me why I love playing so much. And I got a tournament next weekend and then a tournament 3 weeks from now, so I gotta love it, right? Because there's a lot going on. But that's why we didn't have the Friday pod, so we're gonna try and make up for it today. Lots and lots to talk about. Primarily haven't kicked off the show with the NHL in a bit, but it will be happening here. The draft, some trades, some free agency primer as that is coming up very, very soon here. And then, of course, Wimbledon, the final on Sunday. Interesting. Obviously, Max can have his notes on the play. I might have some notes about Mr. Kyrgios. Really, really good stuff there. And we'll just see where the podcast takes us. I'm looking forward to diving into it today with you, Max.
Yeah, and we've got not just some hockey, but some Toronto stuff to kick us off here. As what exactly does future considerations mean? It seems like the Leafs have given up nothing except salary cap space to acquire Matt Murray from the Ottawa Senators.
Yes, the big time move happening about 30 minutes before our time of recording here. And in the NHL, in the MLB, future considerations often does mean nothing, a conditional seventh, a bit of cash that isn't linked to the salary cap. It's usually not much. And so the Leafs acquiring goaltender Matt Murray at 75% of his salary cap hit, that would put him at $4.6 million per year. They also get a third and a seventh round pick from the Ottawa Senators in that deal. And Leafs Twitter, Leafs fandom simultaneously combusted, and the world is ending right now in Toronto. I don't know what else to say, except that I'm going to try and take a positive spin on things here, because you have to when you've been on the other side, just hoping that Matt Murray was going to be your goaltender of opposition the last couple of seasons when he was in Ottawa, as a Leafs fan going in. It's always a circus when these two teams play, lots of goals, but you knew that if Matt Murray was in the opposing net, just the way that he had been playing, you had the best chance to win. And he is going to be taking Jack Campbell's spot, most likely, just in terms of salary, even though Ottawa retained 25%. I didn't think that was enough. And I guess the Leafs are just hoping that their regular season team is going to take them to the playoffs, and then playoff Matt Murray is going to show up. It's true. Like, you look back in the last 10 years, there are two goalies to win two cups in those 10 years, and it's Vasilevsky and Matt Murray. So, and then just outside of that is Corey Crawford, of course, but, and Jonathan Quick are kind of in that 15 year range, but yeah, it's a short list, and Matt Murray was incredible in his first couple of seasons there in Pittsburgh. He's lost that magic, but I guess the Leafs are really hoping they can rekindle it. And I don't know if I see it, and I'm worried that they paid a first to get out of Mrazek, and now they're locking themselves in with another expensive potential bust option here. And I don't know. Even though it's 4-0, the salary cap implications are more disastrous, and it also blocks them from getting another star goalie for the foreseeable future. So I don't know what to make of this, and it's really a wait and see type trade, as a lot of the Leafs trades are at this point. It's show me what you got, but based on track record right now, I'm not feeling great.
Yeah, a couple things I want to touch on here. I'll start with what I think the upsides of, I don't want to confirm moving off Campbell, because that, I guess that's not guaranteed, even though it seems quite likely. But I'll say putting a dent in the salary cap, that means we can't sign Campbell to a big time deal. As we see with Matt Murray, like, some duration of excellent performance from a goaltender does not guarantee that signing them to a big long-term contract is going to be worthwhile and not bust. And there were signs of Campbell even throughout this year. He did recover well, and in hindsight, he managed to put some good performances in between the shaky ones, even during that rough stretch. But there is, as with all goalies, the danger of the snowball effect, where once it starts going downhill, it really seems impossible to reroute. And after just one, I guess say 1.5, because he did end the season before pretty well, it's not enough to tell me that this guy is worth like a 6-7-8 year, like $7-8 million deal. So we get off that risk, at least by making this move. With Matt Murray, I do think the Leafs system is going to give him a better chance than the Senators did. This is a team that has, over the past few years, really placed the emphasis on tightening up their defense. And I do think some of that does lend itself to the success Jack Campbell has had. And I think playing in front of a team that has made defense such a priority will be easier for Murray than in front of this young Ottawa Senators team. Obviously, Mrazek did not play well for the Leafs, and I can't think of the goaltender's name who will be the starter for the Senators moving forward. I know it's the Swedish guy.
Anton Forsberg.
Yeah, and that's why the Ottawa Senators were willing to pay a price to deal Murray to move off the cap, and because they have their starting goaltender going forward, who played better than Murray throughout the last while. And so that's not a 100% argument, but I do think there is some potential upside for Murray, and it wasn't all aces guaranteed signing Murray to Campbell to that big time deal for the Leafs. And then I guess I don't know how much more you want to go into this trade for the Leafs. I think there's another trade the Senators made that we can transition into once we're done on the Leafs side of this. But if you have any more Toronto thoughts before that.
We can go from here. Both teams making trades. near the trade deadline. But yeah, it's a high risk, high reward move.
Let's say medium risk. Like I don't see sub $5 million deals as high risk.
I do when you're locked in them for 2 years in your Stanley Cup window, right? Where it could really hamstring you if he is a non-factor, because I don't think you'll be able to LTIR him next year. And so you could just write off 2 years of your window if he's not the guy. So I think you believe if you're Kyle Dubas that peak Matt Murray is just as good as what peak Jack Campbell could give you. And in the end, you're getting him at a cheaper price tag. So you look at it from that perspective, it's a little bit more easier to swallow. But again, like I said, wait and see. And we can move off here really quick to talk on another move that the Leafs made regarding goaltender, moving Peter Mrazek to the Chicago Blackhawks, along with their 25th overall pick in the NHL draft, and they get pick number 38 in return. This was a move I actually did love, because Dubas, a guy who has his favorites, he locks into players, and they knew they could get Minton Fraser at 38 when one, and so they move Mrazek, which is a net positive based on how he played last year, and they still get the guy they wanted to draft, or at least that is what they tell us. And Minton Fraser, highly competitive, highly intelligent player. And the part that I loved, he is playing as a part of the Cam will be hosting the Memorial Cup next year. So a bit of exposure for Minton Fraser there. But like you said, Max, solid move from the Leafs there. And then on the other side, the Senators quite active at the draft as well, dealing their top 10 pick also to the Chicago Blackhawks, along with a second and a third rounder for Alex DeBrincat, who is a bona fide goal scorer and probably a better player than anyone you could hope to draft. Or you maybe could draft a better player, but you wouldn't know for 4 or 5 years. And so they get an excellent player, Brinkett. You have to still fit in their rebuilding window. They give up some draft capital, but that was something they were of some moves the past couple of years to accumulate that stockpile, that war chest of draft picks. And they moved to get a player that they liked. And as a Leafs fan, I don't like it, which is why it's a great trade for Ottawa. And Max, I don't know if you have any additional thoughts to add here, but it looks like Leafs and Sens making some good deals on both sides.
Yeah, I think, like you said, this makes sense, mostly just window-wise. The Senators' time is soon, and top 10 picks now are, if you knock it out of the park and land like a Draisaitl, that can be a soon. Otherwise, you've got to wait quite a while, and that is past the window that they're going to be heading, with them having just signed Tkachuk last year. That's kind of indicates what their time frame's at. So like you said, I hate this trade as a Leafs fan, which means it's a great trade for the Senators. The other thing that I find interesting about this trade is it kind of indicates Patrick Kane might not be a Chicago Blackhawk that long, at least in my eyes, because it shows from the Blackhawks moving off a player like DeBrincat, they are not thinking about winning anytime in the near future. And when you have someone as valuable as Kane, why would you hold on to him, unless I've missed your notes and he's a free agent? But no, I don't see that. So I'm wondering if we're going to see Kane moved sometime this offseason. And did Taves play this year? I did not follow the Blackhawks at all.
He was hurt. He did play. It just looked like he wasn't having a great time the whole year.
Yeah. So I imagine at the contract he's at, and with that dip in play, that would be a much harder trade to make for the Blackhawks. But who wouldn't want to land Patrick Kane?
Really, really bizarre, though. Talking Chicago now, that they have moved these two young players at a time when they are looking to rebuild, and not moving the aging veterans that could bring them a pretty substantial players like Alex DeBrincat and, of course, Kirby Dach, who went to the Montreal Canadiens for a first and a third round pick. And yeah, both of these kids are very early on in their careers and are going to be really, really great hockey players for both of these Canadian teams now. And Chicago, I guess, for some reason, 23 and 24, the biggest thing to note here is I got Chicago on Connor Bedard watch. Looks like they're the first team to really pull the parachute, and the season hasn't even begun.
That is another consideration, especially if we see them move Kane. That makes a lot more sense. I mean, look at what Austin Matthews has done for Toronto. Look at what Connor McDavid's done for Edmonton. And that's 100% the category that Connor Bedard seems to be heading towards. So why not, first, I guess?
Yeah, first overall picks. I think that's a perfect time to transition here to the NHL draft, where Bob McKenzie keeps his streak alive. Since 2009, if you bet on Juraj Slafkovský, you made a pretty penny on draft night in front of the hometown faithful. The Canadians go against the initial favorite to be picked over for first overall in Shane Wright and go with Juraj. Slovakia having two of the top, the two top picks in this year's draft as Simon Nemec follows to New Jersey. And then from there, Arizona was absolutely locked in on Cooley. And so that means Shane Wright, after being the dubbed first overall pick for many, many years, like a McDavid, like a bit to be just giddy and overjoyed Seattle Kraken. They get Beniere last year with the second overall pick, who many had rated as the top player, and now they get Shane Wright, who many have ranked the top player as well. And so they couldn't have worked out better for them. But Montreal going with the big lefty, and he looked pretty decent in warm-ups today under a really big crowd of people congregating to watch Canadians practice with a lot of the young players. Look good in front of the net. He is a true 6'4", really stands out. He's a lanky dude. A lot of comparisons to Pierre Engvall, but Slafkovský, you can tell, is going to grow into that body, and I think he's going to be a very dangerous player and is sliding in really well with potentially 3 years from now, Suzuki and Caulfield as a job. They obviously saw something in Juraj that they loved a little bit more than Shane Wright, and Wright now has that chip on his shoulder coming up for Seattle to do some great things. So I'm looking forward to seeing what all of these top prospects can do coming out of the draft. But a little bit of drama there on draft night, and a really entertaining draft to take in.
I really can't remember the last time that happened in the NHL. I don't know if it has happened in my lifetime.
Yeah. Gary Bettman, of course, killing the mood a lot of times, but it was a wheeling and dealing draft night, as we can run through some of the trades here, Max, and let me know if any of them stand out to you. I mentioned a couple, but Alex Romanoff to the New Islanders, fourth round for the 13th overall pick in this year's draft. Vitek Vanecek from Washington to New Jersey for a second and a third. That set the price in the market as Detroit gets the negotiating rights to Ville Husso of the St. Louis Blues for a third round pick, and they end up signing him to 3 years, $14.5 million total, so a $4.75 million cap hit, right around the price of one Matt Murray. Leafs fans, cover your ears. First round pick in this year's draft, and Zach Kassian in return for a first round pick from Arizona. Feels like a steep price to pay, but obviously Kassian taking up a lot from him, and Arizona adds to their war chest of draft picks there. Tony DeAngelo to the Philadelphia Flyers, along with a seventh round pick for a fourth, third, and second. from Carolina there. And Philadelphia getting mocked for that one because it feels like Ryan Ellis may not be ready to play again this year. And that is looking like a terrible trade for them when they got him from Nashville, and D'Angelo looks like a bit of a stopgap there until Ellis is healthy. And then lastly, another goalie, Georgiev, for 2/3 and a fifth, not a high price, but not outrageous to get a really solid goaltender there, as he has just been beaten out by Shesterkin for obvious reasons, but has had some great performances as well, most notably against the Leafs. And so some young goalies moving around, and lots of transactions there at the draft, Max, if there's one in particular.
Which year did you say the Arizona first was?
That would be this year.
It was like a later one in the pick that they'd acquired.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Never mind. I thought
they
that
had
was
three first round picks.
Gotcha. I thought that was going to be like next year's first, which would have some value. I think we can move on to Wednesday's free agency flooding, because there is going to be a flooding.
Yeah, there's some big names here. The potential, the unrestricted, or not all of them, could become free agents yet, but very possible here. Patrice Bergeron, Claude Giroux, Johnny Gaudreau, Nazem Kadri, Phil Kessel, Andre Palat, Evgeny Malkin, who basically all but confirmed that he will be a UFA this upcoming week, as he mentioned that he's never had that opportunity and wants to explore his options. John Klingberg, Nick Leddy, Stanley Cup champion Josh Manson, and PK Subban, along with, of course, Jack Campbell, Thomas Greiss, Braden Holtby, and Darcy Kempfer, also a Stanley Cup champion there. Max, some big names up front there, and a couple of top guys. Number one guy to get in free agency.
Matt, there is like all these guys, Giroux, Kadri, Malkin, Bergeron. For me, like, it's a question of what price, because I don't think these are guys that are single-handedly gonna make a non-contending team a contender. And only really I can't think of many contending teams that are going to have the salary cap to give them the contracts these guys might be asking. Kadri and Gaudreau, a lot younger, I guess. But like, if a Malkin, Giroux, or Bergeron, I guess especially Giroux, because he still wants that cup so bad, decide to take a bit of a bargain, decide their max contracts in the past have set them up for life, and they want to go cup hunting, I think a sign there could really bolster one of those rosters. Like, you look at the difference Kadri was able to make as like a $5 million cap hit on the Avalanche. Like, obviously he's not going to settle for that after the season he's just had. But the question for me is just, do these guys want to win, or do they want to get paid? Phil Kessel, I imagine, has not had the performances of late. That one could be really interesting as well. Klingberg, a really solid defenseman as well. Sorry to see him go. And then obviously Jack Campbell as a goalie is good. There's always going to be a team that's willing to pay out big for a goal. Do you think he still has some time left to prove? Or do you think he's like a bona fide elite goaltender at this point in his career?
I don't think any of them are, per se, the ones that are available. But option feels like a lot of these guys would be perfect in tandem as options there for contenders. And yeah, just taking a look at some of these names, Claude Giroux, funny you should mention, he wants to chase a cup. It feels like the front runner right now to sign him is his hometown of Ottawa, which would be interesting. don't know if that makes them a contender. So he's going to have to balance coming home versus how quickly he wants to get into the playoffs and how much time he believes he has left as a high level player at this point in his career. But fascinating to see. I think Kadri and Gaudreau most likely to stick with their teams, as Calgary and Colorado have carved out quite a bit of cap space for themselves with some moves, with some people leaving down the lineup. And I think those teams will actually be able to re-sign their stars there. And then I'd be down a team like Carolina potentially does, what a team like Detroit does, jumping in here with their cap space. I think those are some other sneaky teams. Edmonton looks like they're trying to put Mike Smith there on LTIR to generate some cap space as well. And with Evgeny Malkin leaving, that frees up a ton of room for the Pittsburgh Penguins. Could you imagine a Crosby Bergeron center duo down the middle? Now, we've seen it for Team Canada. Yeah, it was quite effective, but definitely a possibility for sure.
Yeah, that, I guess the cap space freed up. I think the Giroux Ottawa point to return to, like, we've kind of seen this with Tavares and Toronto, Tavares returning a little earlier in the timeline, and the difference he's been able to make as a Leaf has changed and waned year by year. I still think he's a fantastic captain to have and does make a huge difference on this team, but he's had to adjust his role over time. And I think Giroux even further ahead on that. So I would be really shocked if he signed with the Senators, just because winning the cup has kind of clearly been the priority for him this year with the Florida trade that we saw.
Yeah. I think the guy I'm most excited to see here is Malkin.
Yeah,
if he decides to go somewhere, that is a massive swing, because I think he still has plenty left in the tank, and it's been a couple of years now since that back-to-back cup run. I think with a couple of longer off seasons, he's going to be ready to go and be a massive contributor to one of these contending teams.
Like, watching him in the playoffs against the Rangers this year, it just, the athleticism was such a huge part of his game. The mobility he had as such a big player, and as that goes, or has gone, I think it has waned. But so, like, I think if a team takes a full swing on him, that is a bit too risky and likely won't pan out. But I do agree that he is the biggest name in this class. Probably what, like a top 30, top 50 player of all time?
Yeah, definitely in that range. You could make that argument. And some big names here to move. I don't know how much the needle gets moved at the other positions, but the forward group for sure are some big names to watch this week.
Wow. Well, with the technical difficulties that we suffered through in the middle, we've only got 5 minutes left on this Zoom call. So if that's all for hockey, you can get a couple of basketball notes in and then we'll come back for tennis.
Yeah, I think I'll dive into Summer League a little bit more here once free agency cools in the NHL. But got our first look at Chet Holmgren. He had some sensational highlights, and the rim protection has really stood out as something that's transferred along with Jabari Smith. Was watching a little bit of the Houston San Antonio game tonight, and he was showing his lateral quickness on a couple of moves there. Paolo Banchero, looks like his game is perfect for the NBA. Translate as well into the college scene, and so many talented players on that touches, but already looking so fluid, so smooth at creating his shot. The passing has been an underrated standout point for me, and some big moments for him already, dishing the game-winning assist in sudden overtime for Orlando over Sacramento in Summer League early. And so really fun to see Paolo. And on the other side of that game, Keegan Murray, who caught a lot of slander, mostly because of Sacramento and not because of who he is as a player. But he has quickly silenced the critics with some awesome early performances as well. And Jaden Ivey, an awesome game as well, showing off some of his athleticism. There's been some great young talent on display in the summer league so far. I look forward to breaking it down more. And shout out to Delano Benton and Armani Brooks for their awesome performance in the Raptors' first game there in summer league.
There you go. All right. There's no chance I'm getting through all the Wimbledon talk in 3 minutes. So we will take a break and come back for that.
And we're back from our quick Zoom break there. Wimbledon on Sunday. Not much better. Typically, the last couple of years have not had a tournament on this weekend. Able to partake in some strawberries and cream, but I did fully miss out on the final match on Sunday. So Max is here to give us his thoughts and break down the match, as well as some interesting comments directed towards a drunk female fan at the finals by Nick Kyrgios. But Max, I'll hand it over to you there, bud.
Yeah, I think we'll try and start with the game because it was fantastic tennis from both ends, but we will have to touch on the antics at some point. Yeah, what most people said after watching the first set of tennis was Nick Kyrgios looks like the one who's played in 32 Grand Slam finals, and Novak Djokovic looks like the one who it might be his first, because Kyrgios came out cool as a cucumber. Oh, he was serving so well, and that, no surprise, he's done it all grass season, especially here at Wimbledon. It's been a huge part of his run. He is one of the best servers of all time, without a doubt. But the nerves of a Grand Slam final, his first singles appearance, it's worth noting that he was at the Australian Open Grand Slam final in the doubles section, and he did win that. So there was some recent experience in the battle, and it seems like that helped, because the serve game, fantastic. And when your first serves are just coming up aces and winners or generating like one more put away shot, you almost have no hope as the opponent. But then when you miss the first serve and then do basically the same thing with the second serve, like you just go for it and you're still getting aces, you take away all the hope for your opponent. And it puts so much pressure on your opponent's serve game to try and go stride for stride, step for step, and not fall behind. That's exactly what we saw. Lending even more to that pressure was Kyrgios was winning the longer rallies. It was kind of a head scratcher. On these 50-50 points where it was up for grabs, Kyrgios was somehow finding the angle, striking the ball harder, and taking control on like 7 of the first 8 9 plus shot rallies. A sloppy start to the service game, his third, I think, for Djokovic, sees him go down 15-40, saves the first, and then double faults the second. And Kyrgios, who's historically been a fantastic closer, remains calm, keeps his composure, keeps that deadly serving going, and takes it. But if you'd been watching this tournament, you, as a Djokovic fan, it wasn't time to worry. He went down 2-0 against Sinner, came back, went down 1-0 against Cam Norrie, came back. That's been his MO at so many Grand Slam finals. And so you just knew to watch and wait. And sure enough, early in the second set, on Djokovic's serve game at 1-1, we finally see him get the better of Kyrgios decisively in a long rally, the longest one of the match, 23 points, where Djokovic takes control early, shows his patience, doesn't force a winner and give Kyrgios an easy angle or make an error trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. Just the cold-bloodedness on those long rallies is one of my favorite things to watch in sports, where you have a good angle, you're pressing an advantage, but the winner is not quite there, and you just keep inching it out further, making them go wider, and they know what you're doing, but they just can't do a thing about it. Every time he hits the backhand, like Kyrgios is thinking, is he going to go forehand? Is he going to go line? But Djokovic keeps going cross court, keeps going harder and wider, and eventually creates the winner off it. He follows that one up with a 19-shot rally to clinch the game. And I think it got to Kyrgios's head. Like, he played so well in that first set and was the better player during so many rallies. It was like, oh, right, this is Novak Djokovic, one of the greatest players of all time, and all the ridiculous god-tier things he can do. This is what I'm up against. It kind of sapped his concentration or something for a minute, because suddenly he just dropped a service game. That first set was played at classic Kyrgios pace. I think it wrapped up in sub 40 minutes. He just rushing through his service games. And he kind of rushed through that one. And before he knew it, he had been broken. Credit to him for not going away, like kept it, kind of bounced back, kept his serve, managed to put Djokovic on the break, got himself a love 40 game at 4-4. Excuse me, at 5-3, I believe. But Novak was able to come back, some excellent serving for the most part, and then just a couple clutch rallies. He saves 4 break points, serves out the second set. More, we'll get to the antics, but that's when they really started to come out for Nick. We'll get to them later. Third set sees us go all the way to 4-4. Looks like it's business as usual with Kyrgios up 40 love, drops a first point, and then Novak just claws his way back in. More antics after that, but it got away from Nick at 4-4, and that the Grand Slam experience from Djokovic really showing there, where he just bides his time, waits. You know, the moment is going to come at some point over a 5-set match, and you just have to be ready for it. And that's what these second and third sets were. Novak just playing his game, holding out his service sets, trusting that when the moment came, he would be ready for it. And you never know when that moment's going to come. That's why you don't give up on a game, even at 40 love. That's why you don't give up on a point, even when your opponent has a put away shot to make. You just make them play one more shot, because even if they get it on the next one, you never know if that's going to play dividends later. And that's the play style that the big three really embody. I think Djokovic more than either of the other two. And that's what won him the third set, definitely. I keep wanting to get to the antics, but wanting to stay on the tennis because they're both relevant here. I'll just say, every time it seemed like Kyrgios might be out of the match, every time it seemed like he was in his own head too much after having one game not go his way, he did manage to get his composure back, keep serving it out. And like, in such a mental game as of tennis, like, everyone has games get away with them and everyone has to deal with it and fight their way back. And from that perspective, that's exactly what Kyrgios was able to do, because in the fourth set, they each hold their own serve to tiebreak. One other thing about that third set, Djokovic really did clamp up the pressure. He forced a lot of deuce games that Kyrgios was able to serve out. Just going back to that, like, you never know when the moment's going to come, so you always apply the pressure. And that 40 love or love 40 game definitely did dividends paying. So we go each holding their serve. I would say Djokovic putting a little more pressure on in his return game than Kyrgios was able to. And again, it showed in the tiebreak. I mentioned the second serve terror of the aces that Kyrgios was able to generate, just going for it after missing his first serve. We saw the drawback of that on the first point of the tiebreak as Kyrgios double faults. The moment was tough for Djokovic too. He struggled a little at the end of that fourth set to get to the tiebreak. He had to save a couple break points to get there after making some uncharacteristic unforced errors after getting the mini break. He did drop one of his serve points to put Kyrgios right back in it, but then he returns two deadly first serves. To take another commanding lead, getting those two break points, gets his own two in. He has a 6-1 lead. Kyrgios able to put his next two first serves in and get the points, but Djokovic wastes no time, gets his first serve in, takes control of the rally, and forces the Kyrgios error to win the match. So that was kind of the story. In terms of play, this was a classic grass course match that was mostly decided by the serve. Some really interesting numbers here, though. Kyrgios 30 aces to Djokovic's 15. Kyrgios gets 73% of his first serves in to Djokovic's 63%. But for points won off of first serve, 83% for Djokovic, that's 62 of 75 to Kyrgios's 70% on 64 of 91. Despite Kyrgios serving more accurately, harder, better on the first serve, Djokovic, just the godly returns that he started making in the second set, just, I know the feeling of feeling like you've got it on your first serve, and then just the disbelief as you see that ball come back to you and suddenly you're in it for a rally. Not a huge difference, but on grass, it's the tiny margins, and that ultimately was it. Djokovic's ability to get just enough of Kyrgios's first serves in play, create rallies, was the macro level difference. The other stat that really blew me away from the match, 17 unforced errors from Djokovic through the four sets. Seven of those were double faults. He made just 10 unforced errors in 3 hours of play over four sets, on the hundreds of points played. It's like Nick said, he's a bit of a god, Novak. So that was the match. Antic wise, like I said, the first set really calm from Kyrgios. When he got broken, that's when the displeasure started to show. There were kind of two perspectives, or I heard commented on. One being, wow, for Nick Kyrgios, he has stayed incredibly composed through this match. And the other being, who the fuck lets this guy play tennis? This is a disgrace to the sport. The hard thing to watch is just he takes his own play out on his box. Like he was the really baffling one was both 40 love and love 40 games that Djokovic was able to win, both when Kyrgios went up 40 love and Djokovic came back, and when Kyrgios had a chance to break at love 40 and Djokovic came back, he was screaming at his box like it was their fault, they weren't clapping and supporting him enough, and that's why he lost those games. It's a way of de-stressing from the situation, dealing with that awful feeling, because it really is, you've done it to me so many times and I hate it. And sometimes I wish I had someone to scream at. So for me, it's just a question of like, does his box understand why he's doing that? Is it all good before the match and all good after the match? If there's no hard feelings from them, I don't feel like we as outsiders have the right to judge him for it. But that, for me and the commentators, probably the most controversial part of his antics. I'll take a little break here and let you weigh in before I'll just remind you that's another Sports Next Door January hot take that has died as Djokovic has won a Grand Slam now this year.
I was hoping we could skate by without getting to that point, but yes. Held up for 7 months there. Not too shabby, but of course that is gone. So we'll move quickly along from that. The antics there, you got to imagine the box is aware of it. I mean, this is Kyrgios's probably most notable moment and largest audience, but he has been now playing on the ATP Tour for, gosh, like around 8 years now. Yeah, it feels like
he's 27, yeah. So about 8 years.
Yeah, so he's been doing this for a while. The people in his life and his coaching staff,
no coaches.
or in the box there. Yeah. They know what he's like. It's accepted, and they obviously wouldn't be there if they took it personally. So, yeah, not too much to be said about that either. You gotta just kind of accept who people are sometimes. And I mean, it took him all the way to the summit of Wimbledon, and he was very close and just ran into the goat. So, yeah, tough one for him there, and doesn't help when you've got a woman who's had over 700 drinks, trying to get in your head while you're playing. Right.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the more respectable or like decent moments, because he was like, look, there's someone heckling me in the crowd. This is exactly who it is. And the umpire made a phone call, and Nick didn't complain about her heckling him again. So that played out more or less exactly how it should, I felt like. Another point the commentators mentioned I liked, I can't remember if I've said this on the podcast before, but like, if you've ever seen Draymond Green play basketball, then Nick Kyrgios like seems pretty reasonable on court. It's just a different standard in tennis, and maybe that's for the better. But what's not normal is being alone out there for 4 hours in such a intense mental game that requires the ability to stay so resilient and forgive yourself for so much and not lose your cool. So I think that's something, because so many players do it seemingly so effortlessly, we forget. But yeah, I think like fans I've noticed of Federer and Nadal especially really could not handle the Kyrgios antics. I think tennis fans have just been treated to such a standard. Those types of fans also probably didn't enjoy the red Air Jordan hat Kyrgios decided to wear at the end of the match. And then that's Kyrgios. I guess I'll wrap up by saying, like, I hope to see more of him. I'd hope to see this as a building block in his career. Who doesn't lose their cool? Like the way he handles losing his cool is different than most players, but I don't think the collapses he had in this match were uncharacteristic of a player in their first Grand Slam final against the GOAT. I think everyone loses a game, gets discouraged, and has to recover their play. And for the most part, he did that quite admirably. The match could have gotten away from him so many times, and he was able to bounce back. This was top level tennis. Some of the shot making, I don't think I've touched on, was just absurd. Like, you can talk about the tweener he put an inch over the net from the backcourt that forced the error from Djokovic. You can talk about some of the touches he was able to generate at the net. You can talk about some of the ridiculous forehand winners he was able to generate. I briefly touched on the rallies he won in the first set. But there was so much brilliant tennis he put on display from purely the game itself. The tour is so much better off with him playing. And you've just got to hope that he is putting it all together and there is more and better things to come there. Because the sport deserves the best level of play, and he's able to bring that, especially on grass. But I do want to wrap up the segment talking about Djokovic. I'll touch on the US Open in a later podcast. For now, we'll stay all positives. His 21st Grand Slam puts him one ahead of Roger Federer in the total count, puts him one away from the same man in terms of Wimbledon runs. A lot of the chatter after this that when it's all said and done, Djokovic will probably be remembered as the grass court goat, not Roger, which is something no one could have dreamed of as recently as 2017. His fourth one in a row and seventh at the prestigious tournament. The unforced error is just like low count, absolutely absurd. No one in the history of the sport can drop a set as comfortably as he has can. The tennis IQ and the ability to gather and read off of that. You talk about with any sport, like the team that gives up the first goal, the team that's trailing after the first quarter is by the numbers usually the team that loses. He is just one of the consistent exceptions to that rule. As I said to you by texto, that's my GOAT. So I don't know if you have anything else to add in, but just congratulations to Novak Djokovic. It's always a pleasure, and I had a blast watching him this grass season or this Wimbledon.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure when Wimbledon rolls around, and we're right in the thick of things here as tennis got one more Grand Slam to go, and we'll see if he can catch Rafa. But that's it for today. I think we've really gone through everything we needed to get through. Lorenzo Insigne made his debut for TFC. We'll talk about them when they start winning some games. So we can move on from that. Same with the Toronto Blue Jays, but that'll do it for this one. Thank you everyone for listening. Appreciate it. Hopefully no technical difficulties on this one, but my hopes are not high. And yeah, thanks for continuing to tune in and support us, and we'll be back with you on Friday.
Don't really know if I'm addressing any listeners or just the void on this one, but either way, Sports Next Door signing out.